Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. So this one is really going into classical Buddha Dharma, and what I would really like to do with it is take about a week for every five verses. So of course you're going to have to discipline me. I'll try to behave myself, okay? Is that reasonable? The format is, because we didn't pick a reader last time, I'm going to be the reader. And I just start reading this. Anytime you have a question, consider that it's probably somebody else's question and you're just picking it up. And you ask. Is that clear? Great. I love interruptions, don't I? Thus have I heard. This is the simile of the cloth. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta Grove. This is the traditional way that most of the suttas start. The suttas are, the sutta means the heard or the hearing. And the suttas are traditionally the teachings that are said to have been given either by His Holiness, the Buddha, or by one of his close disciples, and it was agreed by the council after the death of the Buddha that everybody heard this teaching, so everybody agreed. Yeah, that's something we heard him say when they were trying to sort out what was actually the heard teaching, what actually was not. Do you know why it was necessary to sort that out? Because within a week of the Buddha dying, well, first of all, the Buddha, he ate this stuff that wasn't very good for him. And he could either put a lot of his energy in and move it through his body, or he could say, well, I'm in 80 now, and I've been around long enough, and I really think there's not a lot I haven't already told everybody. And maybe if I wasn't here, they could get on with using what I've told them rather than looking to me for instruction. Does that sound reasonable to you? He sounds like a reasonable kind of guy, you know. So he went over to Ananda, who was his cousin and closest to him in terms of Ananda had such devotion for the Buddha that if he was in the Buddha's presence, he went and exerted this loving kindness. So he spent a lot of time trying to be in the Buddha's presence and very little time meditating. And he went to Ananda and he said, tell me, Ananda, have I given you good teaching? Lord Buddha, great. Do you think you have enough teaching to work with? If I lived another 1,000 years, I don't think I could really finish with all the teaching you have given. Excellent, says the Lord Buddha. Walks over to two or three other folks. Tell me, have I given good teaching? Oh. Do you think I've given enough for you to work with? Great, he says. Well, in that case, I'm out of here. At which point they all go, ah, wait a minute, what if we got it wrong? What if, you know, but meanwhile, he's already heard them. They were talking, they were speaking the truth. So he says, no, I'm going to let this work. I'm just going to leave. I'm old enough, you know, I can go. You've got good work. Now you get on with it. So he dies. And all he won't name a successor. You know, wouldn't that be nice? If you just had one authority to satisfy all the quibbles, wouldn't that just be nice? He wouldn't name a successor. You know, he wouldn't change the rules, because he always kept saying there's too many rules, we should get rid of a bunch of them. And he wouldn't change the rules, he didn't do any of that stuff. He just said, let teaching, let truth be your teacher. See for yourself what is real. Now, that's really underhanded, isn't it? Isn't it nicer just to have an authority that you can agree with when you like them and disagree with when you don't? Isn't it? It's a lot more, it's easier to work that way, isn't it? But he just didn't go there. So off he goes to wherever Buddhists go when they die. And then a week later, there's this novice, this newly ordained monk. He had been ordained just before the Buddha died. And it's a week after the Buddha died, and people are going, as you can imagine, feeling like rudderless ships. And he's only been a week in the order. He really likes the robes. Quite nice how they fold. He really loves walking down the street, you know, tall and spiritual looking and having everybody bow to him. That's good. So he says, well, you know, I know he was a great guy and all that, but like, you don't have to be so sad because now that he's gone, we don't have to be so careful about all the rules and stuff. Because I heard you saying that you didn't really think that he meant this when he said that. Mm-hmm. So now we got some leeway. You know, we've got this beautiful teaching, we got these nice robes. Don't have to go to the barber because we get our hair shaved once a month. I mean, you know. We don't have to cook. We just walk down the street and people throw food at us. I mean, hey, we should be grateful and happy what he gave us, you know. And so one of the main elders said, this is trouble. So he called what they call the first council. And it took 3 weeks for all but two of the senior disciples who had attained liberation were able to attend because there was 3 months. There were two that were in retreat in distant places and didn't attend, so that there was later additions or disagreements about some of what was in it. But at the Great Council, what they did was everybody who was present at any of the discourses of the Buddha, Ananda had perfect recall because he was always in such a bliss state. So he would say, thus have I heard. See the first words there? Thus have I heard. This is how I heard it, he said. This was at one time when the Buddha was at living in Sawati in Jetta's Grove. Remember Jetta's Grove there and Sawati? Remember that? Right, that's where he was, and this is what I heard there. So when you see these words at the beginning, you know this comes from the First Council. Everything that the majority of the attendants at the First Council agreed was what they had heard the Buddha teach was included in the sutta, the heard basket of teaching. Everything that wasn't, that nobody, not everybody was sure of, was set aside. It was still valuable teaching, but it wasn't part of the absolute, what they call the canon. This is one book of the canon. It contains 152 talks, which are middle length. They're not long talks, they're not short talks, so they're called middle length talks. Or if you want to sound really esoteric at your next cocktail party, they're called the Majjhima Nikaya, middle length talks. The long ones are called and in Pali, They're called the Digha Nikaya. So now, aren't you glad you know these things? Isn't that truly wonderful? And so this attests to the fact that this teaching has been passed on as an oral tradition. Councils were called regularly. These are things that everybody learned. They learned them together. Some people got a title given to them when they could recite all of the suttas with only, I think it's 3 mistakes. And we're talking minor mistakes, like using or instead of therefore. That kind of mistake. This is one book of 152 talks. You get an idea? There's a lot, right? So, after Sanskrit became the popular language for passing on these texts, these were originally recorded or memorized in Pali, which is a sister language, very similar to Sanskrit. Sanskrit, it was a scholarly language, and Pali was like the southern accent, the slang. Or in Sanskrit, you say karma. That's my karma, if you're really slothful. That's not your karma, blah, 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 karma, right? In Pali, you say karma, yeah. It's kind of a southern accent. That's my karma. Dharma, Dhamma. That gives you an idea of how close the languages were. But Pali was not written, Sanskrit was written. So when the teaching began to go abroad, and a lot of monks who had memorized the sutras couldn't go with it, instead, texts, Sanskrit became a very popular way of maintaining the canon. And so Sanskrit began to replace Pali as the official language of Buddhism. At this point, the people who felt it was really important to get exactly the accent the Buddha used when he said that, and it's lovely that there are people who cross T's so carefully. It's a wonderful thing. It's one aspect. There's the letter and there's the energy, the faith, the heart. Isn't there? You have to have both, don't you? Not only the form, but also the heart that understands what is carried by the form. Not only the vase, but the wine within it. Isn't that true? Both. Just vase dries up. Just wine spills all over the place. Hard to chew it out of the ground. Or have you ever tried that? I don't know. I'm not the only one in the room who's been so desperate, perhaps. So at that point, Pali became a written language. But still, the oral tradition continued. Even though it was a written language, still, and to this day, there are people in the southern school countries who receive a degree for memorizing these sutras. And every once in a while, somebody comes along with a written text and checks them. And their accuracy is phenomenal. That's interesting, isn't it? So you should maybe know that about this tradition. That's what it means when it says, thus have I heard. It means this is one of the things that the week-long new monk was not able to change a little bit for his own interest. This was one that everybody agreed, yeah, this is something that the Buddha said. Okay? And this is where he said it. At Anathapindika's park, there he addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus actually means like homeless ones or wanderers, bums, without visible means of support. That's what it means. Wanderers, those who have renunciates. And the bhikkhus said, "Venerable sir," the Blessed One said thus, this, Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. Is that true? Can you see that's true? If you had a cloth that was badly stained, had a big blotch on it, and you dyed it yellow, would it be a beautiful yellow all over? Why is that? Because of the impurity of, maybe not the cloth, but the color of the cloth. Mm-hmm. And you should also know, by the way, that at this time, many of the people who came to listen to the Buddha were Hindu. And they fully believed that the ritual bathing would cleanse them. That the rituals of their practice themselves had the power to bring salvation. That is to say, they thought that the outer world and objects had the power to change the inner. So he's addressing that directly. Is it true if you just do a couple of good things, everything will be fine? Can you just put yellow cloth on a dirty, yellow dye on a dirty cloth and it will become beautiful yellow? Can you do that with your mind? Right. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. That is to say, if a cloth is defiled, it's probably going to be used for wiping out the garbage can. So if your mind is defiled, it's probably going to be used for wiping out the garbage can of life. It's going to spend a lot of time in the sewers of consciousness. Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were pure and bright, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or pink, it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination. May be expected. I think it's very interesting here that immediately upon whether or not the cloth or the blind feels clear or is clear, that immediately the destination is expected. The action of defilement itself creates the hell. The action of the purity itself creates the God realm. It's not something that you get later. You feel it immediately. What bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? I just want to check this footnote here, footnote 86. I want to see whether it's what I assume it to be. I didn't study well enough beforehand. Please forgive me. Okay, that's okay. We don't want to get that technical. What bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetousness, unrighteous greed, is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will, anger, revenge, contempt, a domineering attitude, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence. These are all imperfections that defile the mind. Knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Now that's an interesting idea, isn't it? Knowing that anger causes you to not have a state of joy, of bliss, you abandon it, do you? And that is, in the footnotes, they say this abandonment is by completely having an experience of insight that shows one what liberation is. So I think these are a few little shortcuts that he hasn't mentioned. Now this is like sort of jumping from knowing it to abandoning it in one verse, and he isn't actually running through all of the stages, because he's not talking about the process of abandoning, he's talking about what removes the defilement. All of this sutra is based, because it was a time where there was a lot of Hindu people listening to him who had a very strong idea about the power of ritual to purify. And he is saying that it doesn't matter how you bathe, how you say the prayers, if you still have these things, you have to abandon these states by some action that totally uproots them, not by some action in the temple. Is that reasonable? Because otherwise this sutra seems to me very unreasonable. Because what he's saying when he uses the word abandon here, he's saying that you attain awakening right away. So you look at anger and you say, oh! And suddenly there you are, living in la-la land with lotuses growing out of every orifice, you know? I don't think so! There might be one or two steps in between. And there are. That's the training. So what he's actually... You're just going through the orifice, aren't you? He's just sitting there with a grin on his face. What did I say? So it isn't that he is saying that you do it like that, nor are you expected to consider that. He is saying that by doing the outer, it's not going to happen. It is by uprooting the inner. It's like my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche said to me shortly after I met him, it's not the outer war, but the inner war that has to be stopped. Stop the inner war, then you're not ruled by fear, you're not ruled by terror, then you have power in your speech. The outer world you can then address. But if you don't stop the inner war, you can't stop the outer. And so I think that's basically what he is pointing at here. So it says in the fourth verse, knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. No, understand there that there's a whole lot of steps to that, but that maybe he makes the aspiration to abandon it at that point, if not actually abandon it. Knowing that ill will, and then it goes through the whole list, anger, revenge, contempt, a domineering attitude, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence is an imperfection that defiles the mind, that causes the mind not to see clearly. You see that when you have, for example, presumption, you can't see clearly because your answer is standing in the way of your interest. Or when you have arrogance, that you cannot see clearly. to see every one of these. They defile your ability to be present with joy. Therefore, they defile the mind. They defile consciousness. Don't they? As soon as you have a sense of what is going to happen, then you don't allow yourself to have the experience, do you? So we're robbing ourselves of an opportunity. And as soon as knowing that these things defile the mind, there are imperfections that defile the mind, a bhikkhu, a wanderer, one who is a renunciate, abandons these actions, these thoughts, these motives. When a bhikkhu has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, so that's like lots of steps. But you can see by once or twice having some success and then getting some heart from that because you feel better, okay, let's do it some more. Then there comes a point you think, oh, well, I've done that, now I don't have to do it anymore. Then you fall back into it again. So you say, oh, maybe I do have to do it just once or twice more. Right? You get back involved with it, and then pretty soon you're involved in the process, and you're not trying to get yourself to some safe place. You're interested in mind itself. When you're interested in mind itself, then it's only a matter of time before you actually have uprooted those states, because those states stand between you and your interest. And then, pretty quickly, you have abandoned it. When a bhikkhu has known that ill will, negligence, and so forth is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, all through the whole list, he acquires perfect confidence in the Buddha. Thus, this is the traditional way that the Buddha said one should meditate on what it is to be a Buddha. He said that you can't really understand this meditation unless you have experienced some degree of liberation from defilement. But nonetheless, it's good practice even if you haven't. So this is the one that you hear, for example, Uttalavanta Sayada, chanting Yatipiso Bhagavarahang. You know that one? Any Theravadan tradition. This is also in the Mahayana tradition. This is also in the Vajrayana tradition. You will find this teaching in all the traditions because it is the Buddha's description of how one should reflect on the state of being a Buddha. And it is, of course, a formula, so I'm not going to go into it in detail here. I wrote a meditation on it some time ago, and if you want to have a copy, you can like sign a piece of paper or something downstairs, and next month when I come, I'll bring as many copies as you want. So that's pretty straightforward. It's quite lovely to do, and the more you do it, the deeper it goes, of course. So this is the formula. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge. There are eight kinds of knowledge of a Buddha. And conduct. The eight kinds of knowledge were covered in the last talk. Do you remember me going through them? Do you remember them?
Praise, blame.
Vaguely?
Praise, blame.
No, that's not quite it.
Okay.
No, yeah. Now the eight kinds, do you want to hear them again? The first kind of knowledge is called knowledge of supernormal powers. Right? That is to say the mind is not attached to material as the way to do it. Knowledge in energy. The energy of motives. The power of love. Yes, it is actually true that if I'm in a room and somebody walks in and they're in a state of hate, I can feel it. In fact, I can feel it if they're walking up the street, if I really pay attention. In fact, they could probably feel me. In fact, if I practice love, everybody benefits. Duh. But then the knowledge that that is true, the knowing that, so that is the way you automatically operate in the world, that's not your second choice, that's your first choice. That's how you operate. Continuously taking the mind into loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, because the knowledge that that has power in the world. Not, I hope it does. Mm-hmm. The knowledge of supernormal powers, that's number one. That's like one of the absolute wisdoms, perfect wisdoms of a Buddha. It is also one of the stages in actually being interested in any spiritual life. First of all, you think there's got to be something else. Right? Got to be something else in the material realm, right? Which is the same thing as the beginning twinklings of the knowledge of supernormal powers, isn't it? And you try pleasure in all the possible mundane ways, and you know it has something to do with pleasure, but it doesn't seem to be that repetitive sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. Right? Because it sort of like takes a lot of energy, and the highs aren't as interesting, and pretty soon you find you're not having the bliss out of sex, you're just getting really blasé about sex. Right? Ho-hum, what's your name? You know, and etc. Isn't that true? Those of you who have done it, if not in the real world, at least in fantasy, isn't this true? And is there a difference? So you start saying, okay, you know, like, you know, here we are basically, relatively, in this world of human beings in heaven. Aren't we? Mm-hmm. Geez, ladies and gentlemen, it's awfully warm here. Do you know what temperature it is outside?
-11.
How come, huh? -11, yeah. How come it's so warm in here? Oh, so I'll just turn the thermostat down. That'd be great. Oh, that's better. I'd hate to have to move my shawl. God realm, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just a little touch hungry. Do I want a melon or a grape? Oh, neither really appeals to me at the moment. Incredible, isn't it? And so having all that, it makes it easier for us to understand that doesn't satisfy everything. There has to be something more, doesn't it? It makes it easier for us to see that. This is a wonderful birth. We have a chance to actually care. And maybe start saying, well, there has to be, what is there about the power of heart rather than the power of possession? What is there about altruism? What is there about generosity that makes me feel better than a peeled grape? This is a reasonable question. And sometime in our lives we should all get to that, because we have so much else given us, don't we? So let's focus on that question, and that's the first step, and that's the first wisdom of a Buddha. Knowledge of supernormal power. Second one is called divine ear. That is to say, you start to pay attention to the motives, to what is humming behind the actions of the world. For lack of a better word, it's called divine ear. In the beginning was the Word. There is the naming of something in some kind of mystical sense of the idea naming before it comes into existence. Can you hear something before it surfaces? Yes, you can. Can you know that you're hearing it? Well, that's another question. Then with the knowledge of the divine ear comes penetration of minds. We're not separate from each other. I hope all of you are feeling fear every day, are you? It's around us everywhere. The whole world is feeling it. I hope you're open enough not to just repress it and say, oh, I can't allow that. I hope your hearts are open enough that you can be aware of the fear and feel it and share it and focus on what else there is. Not deny it and only look at what is not fearful. There's a prayer of fear going in this world. I hope we can open to it. It's not a spiritual life otherwise. It's just clinging to a God realm, isn't it? That doesn't mean you drown in it. That means you allow it. Does that make sense? Some people know what fear is, so they don't have to open to it. It's present. They work with it. We should all be working with it on some degree. Penetration of minds. The understanding, not some parts of yourself that you don't allow because they're not spiritual. Oh, that's not a brass Buddha rupa. I can't let anybody see it. It's got a wart. I got Kathy to call me an asshole today. It has taken me 3 weeks. I am very pleased with myself. I had to list that it, what the world was like if there weren't assholes. I had to go through a very long list. I want you to know I worked for this. It took me about 2 hours nonstop. And she was cracking up. And she... Yes, yes, that's right. And aren't we all? And aren't we all? Enlightened. Yes, yes, and aren't we all? What are you going to leave out? You're going to leave something out? To that degree, you're not being honest. Yes, yes. Penetration of minds. The only way you can't penetrate minds is that part of yourself you won't allow. Then you can't allow it in someone else. Then you've got rules about behavior. Ta-da, ta-da, ta-da. You don't have compassion and understanding. You've got a list of rules. Is this true? Part of yourself that you do not accept, and therefore when somebody else does it, oh. Right? You bet your sweet bippy.
You just got a penetration of mind.
Like, yeah, I'm just pushing the book up. You want to? Or do you think? I am getting far away from this.
Yes.
I'm sort of doing a review of the last sutra. Is this okay?
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Penetrate. Okay. So we did knowledge of supernormal powers. We did divine ear. We did penetration of minds. And then the next thing that happens when there is penetration of minds, then you can see what they call in Buddhism sankhara. Now you've all read Other Lives, Ever Self, so you know exactly what we're talking about, right?
Yes.
And so when you can have a clear feeling of what is sankhara in your life, then you begin to have knowledge of past lives. It's one of the knowledge of the Buddha. Little flickers of things that don't just come from one lifetime, and you know they don't. You don't have any problem with that because you're not dedicated to a self like a stainless steel ball bearing, ruining, rolling through eternity. You don't have to make yourself the one impossible existence in the universe. It's all subject to change. And these seeds of karma are ripening from some other time, some other place. Do you hear that? So, knowledge of past lives. And immediately, then, now, all the barriers are gone. You don't see people as objects. You see activities, seeds of karma ripening in this mind, that mind. You see knowledge of passing away and reappearance of beings. That's the next one. At which point, you understand what is defiled mind and what is not. Because you see how perpetuated states occur of blindness. And immediately then, the next sixth one is destruction of cankers. Cutting through the defiled states. Knowing this is defiled. Abandoning it. At which point, insight arises. Insight is anicca, dukkha, come on, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, anicca, dukkha, dissatisfactory nature, anatta, no fixed identity, no inherent self. Insight, suddenly clearly seeing that what before one was regarding as duality, there is no subject, there is no fixed subject, there is no fixed object, there is motion, there is activity. Right? It's first this desire, then that desire. Meaning first this reflection of this desire, then this reflection of that desire. This dance. And then at that point, comes supernormal power of the mind made body, what we would call toku. Toku is somebody who has the conscious understanding of how to create, how to go through death, rebirth for the sake of compassion. Not blindly, not in response to these states. Okay, so those are the eight. So that was what. So perfect in true knowledge. Those are the eight kinds of true knowledge of a Buddha. And conduct. Sublime. And conduct means always acts appropriately to the circumstance. Sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable teacher of gods and men, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. So those beings who actually come and say, I am caught in this suffering, there's this lion gnawing at my belly, how do I work with it? The Buddha knows how to tame that lion. To turn it into the roar of joy in the jungle. The roar of victory over suffering. The Buddha, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. Those who wish to be tamed, those who wish to understand how not to be pulled by the wild oxes of the mind in every direction all the time. The Buddha is one who is incomparable in his ability to tame. Teacher of gods and humans. Enlightened. And blessed. That's what a Buddha is. He acquires perfect confidence in the Buddha, thus he knows each of these stages as they are, because he has gone through enough of an insight that he understands what each of these words mean, each of these. I just really explained in detail the true knowledge, or in summary detail. We could go a lot more into each one of those, but that gives you some idea. He acquires perfect confidence in the Dharma, thus, and again, this is the formula. The Dharma is well proclaimed by the Buddha, visible here and now, not something that you get in the future. Immediately effective, inviting inspection, worthy of questioning. This teaching is worthy of questioning. Onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. Something you need to know for yourself, not something you believe because you're told. check it out. That's the message of Dharma. He acquires perfect confidence in the Sangha. Thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples, Sangha means community, is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way. It doesn't deviate, it doesn't lead you meandering around the garden. This is the straight way, the Eightfold Path. Practicing the true way, practicing the proper way, that is to say, it is moral, so therefore by practicing in this way, you don't invite unwholesome reactions from the world. The four pairs of persons, the eight types of individual. This Sangha, the four pairs of persons are the eight types of individuals refer to the experience. There are four experiences of liberation from delusion and suffering that are required before one has fully broken the bonds of ignorance, that is, ignoring your true nature. There are four levels. First one is called stream entry. The last one is called arahat. I'm going to cut this a little bit short. So there's four levels. There are eight stages because there is the experience of stream entry and then there is the knowing that experience. Just like the first time you have the experience of something, you don't have any words for it. You're just bare experience, just involved in it. And then there is a naming of the experience. So that's the eight types of individuals. Four types is like the experiences. The eight types is the experience and the knowing of that experience. They're called classically, in classical Buddhism, the path experience and the fruition experience. And also in Western mysteries, you talk about the 10 stages. The 9th stage is perfection. The 10th stage is completion. That is, knowing what you have perfected, knowing how to name it, knowing how to talk about it to others, knowing how to be present, knowing how to shut up about it to others. So the 8th types of individuals. This Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts. That is to say, they are using gifts. They're not going to get caught up in them. But you remember that sutra that I put in the little text I gave you in the graduated path, that little sutra at the back about the 8 worldly ideals. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. The difference between an uninstructed and an instructed being is that when an instructed being comes across praise and blame, gain and loss, etc., he knows them as they are. He doesn't think that they are him. He doesn't think, oh, I really deserve this, I'm so good. He thinks, oh, this is nice, this is a gain, and it's not going to last. It's impermanent. So therefore, worthy of receiving gifts, worthy of hospitality. You can give to Sangha without creating pain. Worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world, that is to say, by giving to, you know, taking hits on, cows or something. God knows, you know, some major difficulty in the world, and you thought you were doing good, then you feel divided about it, and you feel guilty, and blah, 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 right? I'm not going to give. It's easier not to give. Because there isn't a feeling of generosity in my giving. I'm always checking it over. I don't know if I gave to the right thing. Should I have given more? Should I get, right? Whereas with the Sangha, says the Buddha, when you actually are working with the Sangha, they're worthy of receiving gifts. Whatever gifts they get are for the benefit of all beings. They're not on a power trip. So therefore, they're an unsurpassed field of merit, because it's wonderful to be generous, isn't it? Especially if you think later you're not going to get a lawsuit for it or something. Okay, so that's what the three meditations on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, that the bhikkhu who has cut through the defilements of the mind or abandoned the defilements of mind, then his mind automatically turns to looking at the three clear statements about what is a Buddha, what is a Dharma, a law, a teaching, and what is a community that practices it. He knows that, he understands it for himself, he sees it clearly. When he is given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished, that's quite a lot of things to do, the imperfections of the mind, in part, so the first one was when he does it in full, second one is in part, and that should be partially. So not full arahat, but the third stage of insight, right? He considers thus. He doesn't see clearly why the Buddha is so wonderful, but now he says, I am possessed of perfect I know that the Buddha is wonderful. I don't have the knowledge of why. But my sense is that the Buddha is wonderful. If he has attained arahatship, which was the last one, when he has totally abandoned them, now if he has gone to the third stage of the experience of the path, when he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished the imperfections of the mind in part, he considers thus, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Buddha. And he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains gladness connected with the Dharma. He says, God, I'm lucky to have this teaching. When he is glad, rapture is born in him. It's true, isn't it? And one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. Yes. There's nowhere else to go. You don't have to search. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. Yes. In one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. The mind is at rest. So you hold the mind somewhere, it stays there. He considers us, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Dharma, and he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains gladness connected with the Dharma. When he is glad, the mind becomes concentrated, the same stages. He considers, I am possessed of perfect confidence in the Sangha, and he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains gladness connected with the Dharma. Oops, sorry. Yeah, that's right. When he is glad, the mind becomes concentrated. He considers that. Thus, the imperfections of the mind have in part been given up. I know what it is to give them up, because in part I have had that experience. Expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished by me. And he gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains gladness connected with the Dharma. When he is glad, rapture is born in him. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure, and one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. All is without going to a movie. Bhikkhus, if a bhikkhu of such virtue, such a state of concentration and such wisdom, eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice along with various sauces and curries, even if he goes on alms round and he gets this alms food that's like, you know, 5-star restaurant, he's not going to say, oh yeah, I'm going back for seconds. Even that will be no obstacle to him. Now you got to understand, for the bhikkhus, one of the big highs of the day, if you were looking at for distraction, is alms round. So here it is, you know. I can remember in mango season, you know, which is most of the time, there was one particular mango that only really ripened at a particular part of the time, and I could have real equanimity walking down with my little bald head and my robes, you know, carefully done around me, over the alms bowl, carrying it down the street, with my eyes cast 10 steps in front of me, walking carefully down the street. Someone would say, Michi, I will none, I want to give you alms. I would pause where I was walking, and I would turn carefully toward, and I would measuredly take steps toward, and I would stand and when I could see their bottom of their body, because you don't look them in the eyeball, and then I would move the outer robe, and I would lift the lid off my bowl, and I would stand there holding the bowl, meditating on just being present and watching the action, and this hand would come, and it would put one of those mangoes in my bowl. And I would go, mango. So I really could appreciate this particular verse, you know. If a bhikkhu of such virtue and such a state of concentration and such wisdom eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice, it's going to perfume this rice. Perfume, like basmati, only more so. And fresh, you know, not shipped from India. Along with various sauces and curries, even that will be no obstacle to him. Isn't that a good idea? Those of you who are more hate types than greed types probably have a little trouble with that verse, but I just can really identify with it. Just as a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water, or just as gold becomes pure and bright with the help of a furnace, so too, if a bhikkhu of such virtue eats alms food, that would be no obstacle. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind, that is to say, he abides with his mind cast not just at what is present here, but right on, right through, evenly, to one quarter of the world in front of him, with a state of kindness, the same kindness for the hill rice as for the bowl, as for the arm putting it in, as for the dog wandering around, wishing it could have some food, bad tempered, trying to bite you, you know, and so and on. Just one quarter of the world that way, imbued with loving kindness. One quarter of the world behind, imbued with loving kindness. One quarter of the world to the right, imbued with loving kindness. And one quarter of the world to the left, imbued with loving kindness. Is doing this practice with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so also above, so also below, so also around the quarters, and then all realms, seen and unseen, everywhere, and to all as to himself, as I am, may all beings be. He abides, pervading, no difference, equal density, inside and outside. He abides, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He abides, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with, they call it appreciative joy. I was taught it as sympathetic joy. With a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise, the second quarter, the third, fourth, above, below, around, everywhere, and to all as to himself he abides, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, compassion, equanimity, sympathetic joy and equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He understands thus, there is this present moment which is continuously changing, never reaches perfection. Everybody's an asshole. Everything is not perfect. It's true, isn't it? There is this moment of dissatisfactoriness. There is the inferior. There is a cause for the dissatisfaction. There is the superior. There is an end to dissatisfaction. And beyond, there is an escape from this whole field of perception. And there's a ladder right out of it called the Eightfold Path. There is the round of samsara, blind wandering. It is ongoing. It is unending. It is causal. There is a way to see its cessation. And there is a path that takes you out. These are the Four Noble Truths, I think. Page 90, footnote 96. Aha! The phrase "there is this" signifies the truth of suffering. There is the inferior is the origin of suffering. The superior is the truth of the path. The escape from this whole field of perception is nibbana, the cessation of suffering, which I was calling rather than nibbana, I'm calling it the Eightfold Path. So. When he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. I'm sure that's craving, false view, and deceit, but because I was wrong about nibbana, I'll check it out here. 97. It doesn't talk about it. But that is like, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire. That when you see the first noble truth, the second noble truth, and the third noble truth, which is there is dissatisfactoriness, no such thing as perfection, have you noticed? When you understand that the Buddha actually just stopped there and just looked at that, didn't think, oh, if I try harder, oh, if they try harder, you know? All those different stories and contortions we put ourselves through, he just looked at it and realized there is dissatisfactoriness. Then he examined the dissatisfactoriness rather than being driven for it. by it. Most of us, we feel that dissatisfactoriness and we immediately image a carrot that's going to make it go away, right? Then we tie the carrot firmly in front of us, right? And we run like hell trying to get it, right? Don't we? So this is called craving, this sense of dissatisfactoriness. The carrot that we produce is always something that we should have or did have or you should have said or why didn't you say or I meant or, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Continuously there, sometimes very subtle, always there. That's called false view. That is to say, there is a feeling that if you only get something right, that craving will go away. And it's a very seductive thing, isn't it? And if there is the false view of the carrot, then there is the conceit of an I who's going to get it. Do you understand that? So those three together, that triangle, those three together, you know Dorje Palmo dances on a double triangle. That is, craving, false view, and conceit. And when they're purified, clarity, void nature, and the non-duality of the two. Right. But that's way too esoteric for tonight, so we won't go there. Craving, false view, and conceit, those three together are really what makes ignorance. That is, those are called sometimes in old translations of these books, the cankers. That it is these three that are the power of ignorance, and they're tied one to the other. It's like ignorance is a molecule, and these are the atoms, or the elements that make up that molecule. There are three elements that combine to make up this molecule of ignorance. They are craving, false view, and conceit. And in order to work with them, one has to be able to see any one of them. To see, especially to see the object and realize that it's really only a projection based on your desire to get away from the craving. Then maybe when the craving comes up, it's easier just to look at the craving, dissatisfactory nature, the desire nature, right? You don't actually have to run or change the thermostat just because your temperature changes. You could actually just sit there and watch the sense of discomfort, can't you? And isn't that what you have to do when you meditate? When you dislike or like something, you could just watch that energy. You don't have to go through a psychological profile of your great-great-grandfather to figure it out. You could just sit there and watch, what is dislike? What a concept. Revolutionary concept. Just exploring the feeling. It's interesting. So when he knows and sees thus, when he sees suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way to the cessation, his mind is liberated from those three, from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. His mind is liberated from that triangle. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. And when it's liberated, you know. Because you are not driven by the desire, you are present, able to see the desire. So said the Buddha, there is dissatisfactoriness, but no one caught. He understands birth is destroyed, being subject to birth, being pushed into a birth with no choice. From moment to moment. We're continuously dying and being reborn. The holy life has been lived. The full potential of being has been fulfilled. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Because this bhikkhu is called one bathed with the inner bathing. So now he's talking directly to the Hindu practitioners. Now on that occasion, so it says in the next verse, now on that occasion the Brahmin Sundarika Paradvaja was sitting not far from the Blessed One, and he said to the Blessed One, but does Master Gotama go to the Bahuka River to bathe? But do you fulfill the ritual? Why, Brahman, go to the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do? Master Gotama, the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit. Many wash away their evil actions in the Bahuka River. Then the Blessed One addressed this Brahman, Sundarika Bharadvaja. That's got to be Vaja, Bharadvaja. In stanzas, Bahuka and Adhikaka, Gaya and Sundarika too, Payaga and Sarasati, and the stream Bahumati. A fool may there forever bathe, yet will not purify dark deeds. What can the Sundarika bring to pass? What the Payaga, what the Bahuka? They cannot purify an evildoer, a man who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure in heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. One fair in act, one pure in heart brings his virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahman, that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is not offered with faith and free from avarice, what need you for you to go to Gaia? For any well will be your Gaia. When this was said, the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja said, "Magnificent, Master Gotama, magnificent, Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, holding up a lamp in the dark for those whose eyesight to see form, with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth," that means I would become a monk under Master Gotama, "I would receive the full admission." And the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadvaja received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission. That means first he took the novice vows, and then he took the full 250-odd vows. And soon, not long after his full admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, resolute, the venerable Bharadvaja, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now, entered upon and abided in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what has to be done had to be done, has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And the venerable Bharadvaja became one of the arahants. Sadhu. I had to ask all the questions. But I guess you all had every word was like perfectly clear to the rest of you. Yes.
The triangle. It's craving, false view, and...
conceit. Conceit. Conceit.
Yeah.
Craving.
Yeah.
Dissatisfactoriness.
There must be something that will satisfy that. Maybe, gotta be something around that. What is happening? A microphone. That's what I need. A microphone. I need a microphone. Concede. I.
Okay.
Microphone. False view. Craving.
I think you got the craving part. Didn't you? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the I. Then concede was okay.
Subject. As if I were real. As if I were not arising based on conditions. When you're in a totally open, joyous state of interest and just experience, there's no sense of I. In the middle of an orgasm, there's no sense of I. Whether it's a mouth orgasm from food, or a beauty orgasm from the eyeballs, or an ear orgasm from sound. Isn't it true?
Yeah.
When the body is rocked by ecstasy, there's no sense of yourself.
No.
The gates are open. Huh? Then a minute later, them and me.
That was beautiful.
What's false view again?
Huh?
False view or sweat?
False view is what it is that you project would satisfy that, would get rid of the craving. False view is whatever it is that you project would get rid of the craving, or would satisfy it, or make it go away. Or make you go away, and so you don't feel it, or any of the above. As if that's what you were supposed to do with the craving. That you, you know, whatever you do about the craving is false view.
Is desire and craving the same thing?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Probably. Is it possible to be without craving? The eyeballs blink. Why do your eyeballs blink? What happens if you decide not to blink your eyeballs? Pardon?
Your eyes get dry.
Your eyes get dry. And then what?
Then you blink.
Yeah. You blink. So your eyes don't get dry. That's what you're doing. You're wetting your eyeballs. Did you notice that? Is it possible to only breathe out?
Yeah. The last one.
Once.
You can do it once. Oh, that's lovely. Is it possible to only breathe in? I'm saving breath here.
No way out here.
Is it possible to sit without moving? Why? Because there's dissatisfactoriness. Because there's dissatisfactoriness. The blood is always going around to take that oxygen around, because the cells are always hungry, because you always got to get rid of the old blood, because you always got to take it to the lungs. So you always got to breathe in, and then you got to breathe out. And you sit one way and then the other leg starts feeling a little like, so you got to move that, and then you move that, and then you get this little itch on the side of your head, and then you got to scratch that, and then of course then you got to be doing it. And this is when you're being still. Isn't it? You have your position in one way, and then you shift your bum because it's getting a little numb there, and then you... Right? Every once in a while, when you're totally engrossed in something, you can be unmoving, can't you? You don't even know if you blink. Probably you do, but you don't know. Right? But totally engrossed. And then it's all back again. Isn't it? Adjust, adjust, move, squirm. It's continuous dissatisfactoriness. Continuous, continuous. Just get everything right and then it's wrong. Breathe in, you got to breathe out. Eat, you got to do the dishes. Yeah. Go to work, get paid, you got to pay the bills. Need to go to work so you can pay more bills. Right? Yep. Endless, endless, endless. You win a lottery so then you can pay all your bills, and then you spend twice as much money, and then you need to win another lottery so you can pay your bills. You have a question here?
Yeah, there's an article in Shambhala about that, that nun from Cape Breton, you know, she was about it. She talked about this sort of thing, maybe probably the article sort of talks about what we're talking about tonight.
Payment children?
Yeah. So that in life or here, I mean, we're always trying to fight it. That satisfaction, that craving, like we feel that way, so we want this, we want that, we get this, and there's always this constant.
Yeah, and that's the other thing to realize. There always is a reaction to craving.
Yeah. So how do you deal with that then, in terms of...
Because you know that you're always going to pick an illusory object,
yeah,
right, to satisfy the craving. You know that that's the nature of being alive.
Yeah.
Right? You know that that's the way you're going to do. You know you're going to blink and then a minute later your eyes are going to be dry again.
Yeah.
You know that. So then you know that even though it's not possible to satisfy the craving, it is possible to be a little more skillful in choosing what you choose to go after. Some things that will actually give you a little more satisfaction over the craving than other things. That is to say, if you decide you don't like the way your neighbor plays the drums at 3 o'clock in the morning, you decide, okay, I'm done with shooting him. I'm not going to shoot him anymore because then the police come. Then his wife comes over and attacks my wife, and then she doesn't let me rest about that. She starts coming on to me about couldn't I have found something else to do besides shoot the bugger. You know? It makes all this bigger trouble. Okay, instead of shooting him, maybe I'll buy earplugs. Right? You start choosing what false view you're going to apply with a little more wisdom. And you learn that from experience. Who knows, you know, I've said to you before, you know, I remember you. Wasn't that the Buddha before Dipankara, you and I, we were sitting there in front of him? Remember Dipankara, he was the last Buddha. Remember the one before Shakyamuni, right, remember? Do you remember that? Wasn't that you? What was his name, that Buddha? Remember we were sitting there, he gave that brilliant discourse, and then I leaned over and said to you, you know, if he just had his mustache cut differently. And you said, yeah, no, it's about the way he's wearing his robes. And here we are. Right? Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like we have had many, many lifetimes of trying to change the wrong thing. Right? It wasn't his mustache I should have been focusing on. Right? So for my sins, 2 immeasurable kalpas later, hey, yo, I remember you. You were that other one sitting in front of that Buddha. enough experience, enough lifetimes, we buy the earplugs. We don't go buy the handgun. We buy the earplugs. Do you have any idea how many lifetimes of experience have supported this birth? Not only the pains, but the joys. How much power you rest on. Not only the fears, but the generosities. There is so much in this birth that supports us. I've said that before, I'm saying it again, slightly differently now. You know, so that we can actually begin to look at the choices we made to satisfy the dissatisfactoriness and decide whether we want to do something with a bit more altruism in it, because altruism pays off better. It's got a better interest rate. Your interest is higher. Isn't it? Not your greed, your interest. Your ability to be involved with the world, to be curious, to care, increases with altruism. Doesn't it? Mine does. Doesn't yours? I would think so. Union time. I heard the factory whistle blow. Do you have any last questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
I'll give you the absolute answer to anybody who calls me an asshole. I tell them, that's what every shit passing through says.
Yeah, got it.
When it comes to complete.
What about the mangoes? What do you say about them?
Yum, yum.
Oh, I am a shit passing through. Yes, okay. So you notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your hearts. It just spreads through your body. You don't have your eyeballs closed or anything like that, because you know what'll happen. You know Daisy will come up and bite you. You know how to do that.
Oh my gosh, you keep me in my cramp.
Yeah. You feel like old light. Well, at the same time you're feeling the cramp. You just spread it through your body. Right through your head, right through your legs. You spread it out through this whole room. It just moves through the whole world. So, you know, awareness, knowledge of supernormal powers. You just let that gold light shine out, and it moves right through the Alberta government building. Right through all of North America, right through the world, right into the universe. Endlessly, this beautiful gold light from all of us together. If there's any suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, and mind, you just feel this light just temporarily assuages it, just for a moment. There's this clarity for all beings. You think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there's less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.